Hello, welcome back to Switching Hats, the careers podcast for researchers who are keen to look beyond the ivory tower for their career. Today with me, Linus Bielinski.
And me, Thomas Nickel. After we heard in our last episode from the careers advisor Susan Black on how to go about exploring the plethora of careers out there and how to deal with the somewhat daunting prospect of leaving academia in the first place, today we have a chance to dive into the deep end and explore one of the most exciting and perhaps also one of the most scary career paths for many researchers, and that is launching your own business. You might wonder, how do we move away from the lab bench to a CEO's office, and what is that like anyway?
Well, we are lucky that our guest today knows exactly what that is like and can probably shed some light on these questions. We are joined by Dr. Holly Reeve, co-founder and CEO of Hydrogen Limited, a growing biotechnology company launched now over 3 years ago in 2020. Welcome, Holly.
Hi, thanks for having me. I want to be really clear that I don't have a nice, shiny CEO office. I literally just sit with the team like in the university. But other than that...
Okay,
that's actually nice to hear.
That's a takeaway.
Feels pretty good.
So let's start with the biggest question at first. How did you become founder and CEO of your own company? What was the journey like from being a researcher and then?
Okay, I'm going to describe it as a really straight line, which is kind of how it literally happened. But I want to be really clear that it didn't feel like a straight line and that there were a lot of decisions and we, you know, were at no point 100% sure this was going to happen. But I started my undergraduate research project, chemistry research project in the group of Professor Kylie Vincent. I started off on some quite fundamental research, but then got given a challenge to kind of develop a new biocatalyst system. When it worked, we quickly submitted a patent and I stayed on for a PhD. And we kind of started to think, understand, I guess, how this system could have be of relevance to industry. So really early in that PhD journey for me, I started kind of going to academic industry, joined conferences, learning loads more about the sector and starting to kind of see the challenges that the chemistry sector was facing and started to understand that our tech could be useful. From there, we won some funding to stay in the university, which was really important. So it was a 5-year grant worth £3 million to tackle kind of academic problems with taking this biotech solution to market. And in that time, I got to kind of step out of the lab, start doing more leadership, project management, strategy, IP thinking, industry relationships, build a team of 7 postdocs. And at the end of that was when we started the company. So it was kind of seems like a really straight line, got results, thought they were relevant, started company. But obviously there were challenges along the way.
So you're saying it's a straight line. That's what it sounds like. It sounds like it was a very natural progression into the business management side of things. But did you ever during that kind of clear trajectory, what it sounds like, consider to stay in academia and do academic research?
I toyed with it, I suppose. I think fundamentally, I decided to study science because I loved the real world application of science. And I found for me that got a bit lost in my university time. Also, I think I was never the person that wanted to have 100 ideas and be the best scientist. I was the person that was like, okay, I really like this. Let's see what impact we can create. And I think because of that, the kind of rewards systems in the university maybe didn't suit what I was trying to do. So, you know, my best days were when I had everybody in the lab doing stuff productively and making sure they were resourced, tackling the right problems, like talking to each other. And that's not really what a postdoc's job description looks like. So actually, I think once I discovered the world of startups, which I had no understanding of when I was studying, I think I figured out really early that I wanted to join a startup. I think starting my own one, that's the bit that makes it look like a straight line. But I think I would have been equally excited to join someone else's startup and use that science to create the impact.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say what you appreciated about the work in the lab was more the project management, people management side of things. So now that you are running your own business, is that actually what your work day usually looks like or your work week looks like? That you're purely involved in managing people and less doing the science? Or what does the typical work day / week, if it even exists, look like?
Yeah, typical, no. I think there's kind of 2 modes. It's like fundraising mode and then like growth mode. I think... So a really good piece of advice I was given before I started the company was don't run the science and run the company. Pick one, do that, find somebody else to do the other one. So find someone else who has different skills to you, different, you know, personality traits to you, different things they're really good at and love than you. And that's exactly what I did. So I made the decision to run the company, not the science. And Sarah, my co-founder, CSO, runs the science. But yeah, I mean, as a startup company, our most important thing is people. I think from a lot of different jobs I've had and like university experiences I've had and seen, I've seen teams run really efficiently and teams run really poorly. And I think therefore I've had a huge focus on making sure our team runs perfectly and beautifully and productively, and all the people are individually but also together happy and productive. So I would say there is a significant amount of kind of people management, especially in the early days, but actually now, you know, my heads of teams are learning those skills themselves, so I can focus on way more strategic thinking and things like that. But yeah, so my day-to-day is, you know, is talking to people, is talking to the team, talking to stakeholders, customers, investors, lawyers, accountants. I basically just see myself as a middleman between lots of different people that bring it all together and try and focus everyone in the right place.
Founding a startup absolutely terrifies me. That sounds so scary.
Yeah.
And not knowing anything about the world of business. But it sounds to me that your career path started quite early heading in that direction, and you were starting to manage people even during your PhD and taking things in that direction. So was it scary to found that startup?
People always ask if it's scary, and I actually think being a postdoc is way scarier than being starting my own company. I think I'm blessed with the ability to kind of see the big vision, see the steps, but only actually worry about the next step.
Okay.
Which I think makes it more straightforward. It's like I'm not worrying about step 105. I'm worrying pretty much about steps 1 and 2. But also I also have never tried to be the person that knows everything. I mean, that's a terrifying position to be in if you feel like you're the only person that knows everything and can do stuff. And I actually had a mentor, he wasn't officially a mentor, but someone that had a huge experience in my sector, in startups, in like getting companies all the way through to IPO. And I asked him to found the company with me as my chairman and like a director of the company, like right before it even happened. So I always had someone in my corner that understood governance, that understood legals, that understood so much more than me, and that wanted to support me in that journey. So, you know, I surrounded myself really early with a huge wealth of people that knew more than me about startups. And so I was never trying to, you know, I learned from their failings and their successes, and I didn't have to feel terrified. And I think also someone said to me once, you know, the only training you need to be a CEO is being a CEO. And actually, as a person, I found it heartening that even if this company does not succeed for whatever reason, it could be that it's just deep tech science and sometimes it doesn't do what you want it to do. And that's not a failing for me. And actually for my career, that is likely to only be a positive. Like, I am learning so much in this thing that I'm doing that it's going to be translatable. So as a person, I don't feel like I'm putting my own self at risk. Do you know what I mean?
That's a really healthy outlook on it. I have to say that is really good. That's actually refreshing. You said that you'd surrounded yourself with these people. Did that happen very early on? And did that sort of what drove you towards doing the startup? Or was it the other way around? You decided that you knew this was going in the startup direction and you went out and found these people to bring them in?
I mean, I love people. So I guess a bit of both. So my chairman, Will Barton, I met at a competition in 2013. We won a Royal Society of Chemistry Emerging Tech competition, and he was kind of assigned to work with us. I never called him a mentor. I just would ring him every year or like email him and be like, here's what's going on. And he would give me useful advice. And I just kept that relationship going, not knowing where it would get me, just thinking that he knew the sector inside out. He had a massive network. He was supportive. He could tell me when I was doing something stupid, but kindly. And then once we thought more seriously about the spin out, my professor encouraged me to go talk to other chemists that had started companies, because by that point there were quite a few. And what I found really useful was the perspective between people who had done it like last year or 2 years ago versus people who had done it like 20 years ago, because you get such different perspectives. And if you only get one, I think it would change how you went about things. Because, you know, the people who are still doing it 20 years later have been really successful, but they often attribute that to really specific things that may or may not be true. Whereas people who are doing it right now, they can get a bit bogged down in like the struggles. So it's, I think it's really nice to have both perspectives. So yeah, I did actively build myself a network of people that I knew I could kind of use at that the stage I was in, but that would also be helpful kind of going forwards.
On that point, was it sometimes hard to build and extend your network? Being in academia, was it hard to convince scientists to invest their time into this venture and support your plans?
You've got to separate scientists and entrepreneurs. People that run companies or people who have started companies, they love to tell you what went well and what went hard. And they love to help the next generation of people doing it not make the same mistakes. It's really easy to convince people like me normally to do stuff like this because it isn't something that is easy to understand from the outside, and it is an exciting, amazing journey, and there are challenges. And I think actually most science entrepreneurs want to help you, and they want you to know that being trained as a scientist doesn't prevent you from doing this, because I think that was a narrative for a really long time that we used to hear. So people, I find, are really generous with their time. When you're a PhD student or a postdoc, you're actually in a really powerful position to extend your network, even if you already have an idea for a company, because you're completely non-threatening. You know, I used to find people in massive companies from like papers that they'd got corresponding author on and be like, oh, I'm just a postdoc or a PhD student and you're such an expert, could you help me with, you know? And really, I was trying to help build a business, but I didn't have to be honest about that. I had PhD or postdoc written at the bottom of my, you know, email signature.
So you keep describing this as a journey, and it, obviously at some point in that journey, you needed some funding to kind of push this business forward. What does that look like? How do you go about doing that? And where does that funding come from, at least in your case?
Yeah, I guess it's different for everyone. For me, towards the end of this translation project, when I was still in the university, I went on a program called iCure, which has really grown since I started, and there's now loads of different phases. But iCure stands for Innovation for Commercialization of University Research. So it's all geared up about taking a postdoc with an idea for a company. You build a little team that has your professor, it has someone from your tech transfer department, it has kind of a business advisor. So you have your little team. And they gave me money to go speak to industry for 3 months, to go try and speak to 100 companies across my sector with business support, you know, et cetera. They taught me how to talk to these companies, you know, about asking about their problems, not trying to sell them my solution because I wasn't ready to yet. And that was all designed to help build a business model and to kind of stress test that business model. And at the end of that, if your kind of company or idea look like something that should be a startup rather than being a kind of licensing or whatever else model, they put you forwards for some ring-fenced Innovate UK funding and helped us with that. So I kind of got some, I got like £300,000 from the government, I guess, to start the company. For a complicated reason, I had to have some actual investment as well. I got some through university connections and then some at that stage through a kind of Oxford early stage investment network. It was called Onion at the time. I think it's changed its name, but that's where I kind of met angels and small VC funds. Since then, I've obviously gone on to raise with bigger VC companies, and we're now looking for our next raise that will be even more terrifying. That was the journey for me. But yeah, at some point, you know, you have to put on paper or PowerPoint some plan that looks credible to an investor, for sure.
And you do that every time you have to go to one of these people and say, I'd like some money. You're putting together a whole new plan.
Yeah.
And that must be incredibly daunting. What does that look like? Yeah. What is that sort of environment like?
I'm doing it now because, you know, you're not just saying, this is my plan for a business. You're saying, you know, so for me, it's like a year ago, I raised, you know, 2.6 million. The company was valued at whatever. What have I done in that time? How have I used that money? How have I added value to the company? And what am I going to do next? And where is that going to get us? And what does the future look like? You know, what is an investor that joins Hydrogen going to get in 5 years' time? And, you know, you've got to put into that the science that you're doing, the risk of that science, but also like the customers and what they're doing. And yeah, it is daunting. But again, I don't do it by myself. I have a COO, Matt Hodges, who has done this kind of startup journey before, who is awesome at thinking about all that financial modeling stuff that I could not do by myself. I can add in the kind of science credibility or the kind of, you know, value we might add. But he can stand behind those numbers. So I don't do anything alone ever. That should be my only message.
So my next question was actually going to be about all the business aspects, but I think we've really covered that. I guess I want to kind of switch tack on that and think about how much of these, you said you're really a middleman, how much of these things do you actually have to do for yourself, like the legislative work? Do you get your fingers really into that, or do you leave it to someone else entirely, then taxes and funding and all that? How much of it is done by you, and how much of it is done by your team, and you're just like, yep, sounds good?
I try not to do that. There's a couple of things I might do that on. So, you know, when you're building a leadership team in a startup company, you try and find people that know stuff you don't know. So I've certainly done that. However, you know, Oxford really helps. You know, you start a company in Oxford and they literally give you a list of, here's a list of accountants, why don't you meet some? And decide which one you like. Here's a list of lawyers, you should meet them and see which one you like. And, you know, your accountants are there to keep you in line. You know, it is mostly the accountant saying, it's time to think about R&D tax credits, can you fill in this paperwork? And then, you know, finding the right people in the company that can provide the right information. You want that safety net. You know, you want to be paying someone who knows much more about this to keep you in line. Obviously, you know, we read regulations, we keep up to date, we have a board that makes sure that we're not taking any risks, that we're above board, and we're held to pretty high account. And when investors invest, they want to see data rooms, they want to see that everything's fully dotted I's, crossed T's. I would say that most of these processes are designed to not be that hard to deal with once you've got them set up. You know, we use software for everything financial. You know, we don't, I think increasingly we do more and more, we can do more and more ourselves. But actually, you know, things get more and more complicated as you get bigger. So advice, paid advice, not like advice in the pub from your friend, like paid advice. Yeah.
So about surrounding yourself with people, you described how you need to do this internally in your company, get advice from people, build a network. But you also talked a little bit about announcing who your customers are going to be when you even set out your plans for the future. How do you go about that? How do you pick your future customers, your future clients? Do you advertise? Do you have an idea in mind already who this is going to be? How does it work?
I just love that language about picking our customers.
wishful thinking.
I guess it's like a two-way street. So there's so much to go for that. So when I was doing the marketing, kind of market validation exercise, it was all about thinking about the chemical sector as a whole, understanding the value chain. Let's just take pharmaceuticals. You've got people who make and design new pharmaceuticals, people that manufacture them. Those people might outsource aspects of that to contract developing companies or contract manufacturing companies. Like, it's a really complicated ecosystem, and we add different value to different parts of that. And they all have different timelines and different models for working with people. It is complicated. I would say we're still really early in our really commercial journey. So we really switched from R&D to commercial in the last kind of 6 months. We are selling products. At the moment, we get a lot of inbound requests, so that's really exciting. And at the moment, we do kind of pick which of these partners is going to give us most value and how do we get most value. So that might not be financial. There might be better value that a customer or client or partner can give us right now than cash. I read a really good book called The Mum Test, which anyone starting a company should read, which is basically, you know, if you go to your mum and you say, I've got this really good idea, she's going to say, such a good idea, like regardless. But actually everyone's like that. People aim to please. So if you come really excitedly and tell someone that, you know, you're doing something really great, they're just going to be like, that's so great. So if you're going and talking to a customer, a client, a partner, whatever, it should always be like, what problems are you facing? Would you pay to solve that problem? And once you've established that you might, you know, have a solution to their problem and they might pay for it, that's when you start talking to them like they could be a customer. So all our interactions with other companies start off very discussion-based, I would say. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, in a way. So I'm completely ignorant in how this works. That's why the question came up. So in terms of the staging of the company versus then actively reaching out to clients, you mentioned that for a while you were focused completely on R&D. Yeah. And then it got more into the commercial side of things. So how does this work? Is this usually the case that you for the first year or years or so, you focus completely on research and development before you go out there and offer your product?
well, there's no one size fits all. And there is a complexity to that. So, for example, we had a 2-year, we are still involved in a 2-year Innovate UK, so government funded project with a big chemicals company. So some of that R&D is really focused on a specific process of interest to a big chemicals company. So it's not literally R&D of will this work or not. It's like, can we meet the requirements of this company for this process of interest? And if we can at the end, obviously we expect that or want that to turn into a commercial relationship. So when I say R&D, I guess I don't mean university style R&D. I mean like really hardcore focused development of hitting, moving from like that lab based, you know, we came out of the university, so we came out of running things on a little scale, not that intensified. Like the development is like, how do we get that to look like an industrial process? And we have other strategic partners who are not customers. They are really strategic partners. So people who have, in our case, expertise in chemical manufacturing and building reactors for really efficient manufacturing. And we're like, okay, well, if we can we run our processes in your reactor? And if so, that gives us credibility. It shows the process is running at a much more industrial looking scale, but it also long term gives us a route into working with their customers, you know. So there's no decision that is purely development based or purely commercial based. They need to go together. And then we have customers who will be happy to buy a small amount of product, and then we have customers that like don't bother talking to us until you can make a ton of this because we don't care. So, you know, different customers want different things. Some we're ready to work with, some we're probably, you know, a couple of years out from being ready to work with.
So it sounds like it's a lot about upscaling things after the pure academic lab work where you work on a small scale. And then even if you want to use that same process, same experiments, but on a large scale, this is what lots of the R&D goes into.
Yeah, I mean, your whole thought process on how you make something on a small scale in the lab in the university have to change. You've got to find suppliers that are going to give you consistent materials coming in. You've got to send really consistent material out. It becomes much less about can we perfect this and much more about can we make the same thing every day. That sounds boring. It's not
sounds
boring.
Like a challenge. So how do you go about that when you start to think about how do I upscale these processes to like a huge to get so much more productive? When you think on a larger scale and think about how will my company grow, who do I need to recruit, how many people do I need, how do you go about thinking about this growth process in terms of planning?
It's terrifying, isn't it? So we don't plan to do the scale up in our own labs. So a lot of it is finding really good partners. So one thing we do is we make enzymes. So we grow cells, make enzyme. That's like our biology team. Our chemistry team then use those enzymes to run processes. So we don't intend to manufacture enzymes ourselves. So one of the first really critical steps is showing that we can make these enzymes in like the existing infrastructure that industry has developed to make these enzymes. And for that, we work with partners. Initially just doing the proof of concept work and then literally paying them to make us material. So when we think about resourcing, we have to balance, what do we need to do in the company and what is going to be faster and more efficient paying someone else to do? And obviously there's really different costs and team sizes to that, but they're the kind of ways we have to think about it. Like, is this really best done in-house by us where we have control over IP, but we don't have access to as many facilities? Or is this better done by a partner where, you know, maybe it's slightly more complicated on an information basis, but they're going to be able to do it much, much faster and much, much more rigorously, intensely, or whatever else.
This is really interesting. So this is lots of planning process ahead of time, or do you look at what potential industry partners are there? What people can I recruit for my internal team? And then you make the decision, or do you ignore this completely at first and go back to the paper planning? Say what is most efficient in theory?
I guess it's a bit of both, but you know, we'd like to have a strategy. We don't want to have people hanging around in the team not doing anything, do you know what I mean? So people are expensive and time consuming. So I think at the moment, in the UK at least, it's fairly straightforward as to what skills are, what external skills are available and what's best done by them. Access to skills of people coming into the team is, you know, sometimes harder to achieve. So I think at the moment for us, it's normally quite clear cut. We don't want to invest in big steel in the ground infrastructure. We don't want to be having 100,000 liter scale anything. So that's best done by somebody else.
And for the team you are internally recruiting, what type of specialties are you then looking for? If you have the big production processes and so on, they're outsourced more or less. What is kept in-house? Like, what type of work is then kept in-house from the start?
So, well, I guess they're really specific. So we have a biology team and a chemistry team, and we try to make sure that we have people that sit in the middle that understand both languages. We try to make sure that as a team, we have a really big spread of capabilities and knowledge, but also some really specific individual strengths. So that's how we think about putting a team together. And often, because of how we do our investment and growth cycles, we often hire quite a few people at once. So we hired 5 or 6 people in the last 4 months, say. So that gives us scope to think about that really holistically. Like, okay, if this pool of people, do we have the right really specific individual skill sets, but do we have breadth of knowledge? And that's, I think, really helped us make good hiring strategies for that. And then we always get told that when you up a TRL, a technology readiness level, so once you kind of get to the next stage of what you can do, that's when you need to hire in new next level skills, you know, to challenge your assumptions, but also to drive you forwards faster. And what I'm learning in the chemical sector is that's always a process engineer or a chemical engineer.
Not us then.
Yeah, or me.
So, I mean, the question I've got written in front of me is, what were the main challenges in commercializing your research? I can hear that there are a plethora of challenges. So what are your top two? What are the two biggest challenges you've had to overcome in commercializing your research?
So I think if I were giving people advice for doing my journey, so taking university science to commercialization, I think one is, you know, it's your baby and your kid, and no one thinks that you saying your kid is great means they're great. So hire people that know different stuff. So I trained in kind of very specific, like the kind of biotech, in how enzymes function. So Sarah is an organic chemist who's, you know, she has the skill set of most of our customers. So her coming in and being like, oh, this is really great, that's way more impactful than me saying it's really great. So I think, again, it's that hiring, that people, that network, that not just trying to be a one person band. And then there is going to be so much you don't know, and you kind of have to be comfortable with that. But equally, you just have to seek advice. You can't do it alone, you know, that you can't be an expert. As you guys have already said, you've highlighted so many things, from legals, tax, people, leading teams, getting new labs, getting them kitted out. There's so much to think about. You can't do it by yourself. And if you are by yourself, you have no one to like bat ideas around with. You need someone, you need people.
So would that be your advice to other people?
Find people. Find the right people. And that doesn't have to be super complicated. Find people that think differently to you. Not every situation you should be like in total agreement and really happy about. You know, you should have some friendly confrontation. You should have to find the right answer by somewhat arguing about it at times.
Does that happen quite a lot? Are you say it's good to have that head to head and sort of this push back and forth? Does it happen quite regularly?
Yeah, I think we always argue really politely and smiley. And actually, I sometimes our leadership coaches challenge us that we should argue more. And I'm like, I think we actually do argue. It's just I think we argue quite Britishly. Not that we're all British. We do. We do. We make time to sit down and argue sometimes.
Okay, well,
especially in that commercial team meets science team world.
Okay.
You know, it's like the commercial team are like, oh, we need to push faster and do more. And the science team are like, you know, might be like, oh, I'm not sure we're ready. And I think it's my job sometimes to find the path through that.
So like mediating is a main part of the job.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it's just choosing slightly different words, you know, to make it sound less scary, I think.
How to placate
everyone. Yeah. Words are really important.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Holly, and for sharing your journey as a researcher, founder, and all about hydrogen. So I think maybe for me, it sounds like launching a business is not quite as scary as I thought it was, but I wouldn't. I mean, now I've got some idea where to start. I'm still not sure I've got the.
you got the first step. You found someone who's done it before. So.
Yeah, there we go. Step one. Brilliant. Thank you again, Holly.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much, Holly.